Our final case for today is United States v. Domnenko, both of them, Victor and Lilia Domnenko. Ms. Kasseberg.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Kasseberg on behalf of the appellants, Victor and Lilia Domnenko. As Your Honors are aware, we've raised sufficiency issues in the appeal as well as issues related to the sentencing. And I think that a large part of our appeal can be crystallized into one question, which is where the government concedes that there is no evidence that the defendants knew with regard to the second sale of their home that they were selling it to a fake buyer. How could they possibly have known, how could they have reasonably foreseen that that sale would result in a default and a foreclosure and that they would be then held liable for those costs?
But there were lies in connection with that second sale as well, maybe not quite as long a list, but there are failures to disclose in the HUD-1 form who's going to get the money, and there's testimony that that's a material omission, and it seems to me that there are problems with that sale, whether or not the Domnenkos know that there's no such person as valet.
Well, and I think with regard to the second sale, while the proceeds check after the closing was turned over to an individual named Okulaja.
Well, first there's a lie on the HUD-1 form. It says everything is listed, and in fact, she signs that, and then the second the closing is over, she signs the $129,000 check over to somebody, gives it to Okulaja, off he goes to the currency exchange and distributes it to people.
Well, and I think there's evidence in the record to support the defense's contention there that the Domnenkos, in turning that check over to Okulaja, were repaying a loan that they owed to Okulaja related to a separate business investment that Mr. Domnenko had made.
But that's not the question, of course. I mean, perhaps if a jury had found that, it would have been okay, but there's plenty of evidence that supports the jury's rejection of that exonerating theory.
Well, and, you know, I believe in not to, it was a bench trial, and
or
just,
whatever,
so that,
the judges,
just so we're on the same page. Yeah. I do think
you
that.
It doesn't have to be bought. That's
no, and it's the same factual finding. But I do think that in this case, you know, there was evidence that supported the defense theory that that check was not to the buyer. So to characterize it throughout the trial and sentencing, and for the court's findings to be that, you know, it's critical to note that the court's finding of guilt on that second count of mortgage fraud related to the second sale, as well as the scheme, was because of that, quote, under the table payment to the buyer. But really, the check was not turned over to who the Domnenkos believed the buyer was. And if anything, at worst, could be construed as an incentive payment, and or that's at worst. But
it sounds like you want to argue the materiality of the omission.
Yeah, I think you could. Yeah, I mean, I think that's an appropriate way to characterize it.
That's not, as Chief Judge Wood said, there's evidence from the lender that they would want to know that. And I can imagine that a lender would certainly want to know that the price included, for example, an extra 12 or 15% kickback to the buyer's agent. You could be, maybe it can be explained, maybe it can't. But let me ask you, in terms of materiality, I'm struggling with this. If let's suppose the defendants, as the defendants believe, valet is a real guy, right? We've still got a market price for the second sale that's inflated by the completely fraudulent purchase a few months earlier, right? To the inflated price.
From the first sale you're referencing, right? Well, you know, the first sale is, is the first count of the first count of the wire fraud conviction.
Okay, and is there any doubt about the sufficiency of the evidence on that?
Well, you know, we do concede that the case law on that point and what is required to prove a wire fraud conviction is definitely against us. What we would want to note for the court is that while the evidence showed that the Domnenkos provided false documents to obtain that loan, is that they always maintained the intent to assume the liability on the mortgage. So, you know, to the extent that there's
that's a credibility judgment that the trial court made, whether that was their real intent.
And it's not a defense anyway.
And it gave them a motive to try to make sure that the second sale occurred quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well,
or at a price big enough to get them out from under the mortgage that they couldn't possibly afford.
Well, and I think in terms of the credibility issue, I mean, what was put in front of the judge was the fact that every mortgage payment was made and that ultimately that loan resulted in zero loss. So the
only because
intent,
the second bank was defrauded, though. Yeah, I mean, that's really not a great argument.
But what we believe is that the Domyankos didn't intend to defraud the second bank, that there is insufficient evidence with
regard
to that.
How can you say that, though, when, as Judge Hamilton says, the amount of the second loan bears no relation to the fair market value of this property? Because they inflated it up the first time around. So now they've got to cover the first one, get rid of that. Okay, so maybe the first bank isn't out any money, but it's all because the loss just got shifted to the second bank.
No, and I see that point, but I do think the evidence supports the defense theory there that, you know, this is in the middle of sort of the height of the mortgage explosion. You know, this
we understand you had arguments. Okay, we understand you had arguments on the facts, but... You've got a much tougher standard to meet here.
No, and it's a high standard.
And the district court didn't buy it. I don't think any of us are buying it. I think you should go to the loss, the 14th level loss enhancement, because I think that's your stronger argument.
Yeah,
honestly.
And that is sort of where the contention
Yeah, so you
I
need to spend your time there, because that, to me, has some merit.
Yeah, so with regard to the loss, the application notes for 2B1.1 in the sentencing guidelines require that the amount of pecuniary harm be reasonably foreseeable in order to increase the sentence. And so in this particular case, the Domyankos both had their guidelines calculations increased by 14 points due to
So here's where I want to sort of explore this a little bit with you, and I do also want to explore it with the government. The PSR says that Countrywide forecloses. They get back $487,500, so they take a loss of a little more than $600,000. Now, the guidelines needed to be more than $400,000. So you could say, well, you know, give or take, this is an $1.1 million situation. And even splitting the difference, you're above the $400,000 limit. So I don't know. I mean, tell me why it's not reasonably foreseeable to the Domyankos, either one of them, that there's going to be a loss in excess of $400,000 here.
Well, we vehemently oppose the idea that they intended to defraud at the second sale. But even if you assume...
We're not there.
We're beyond that.
Right,
now
but
we're
I'm
about
just...
foreseeability of loss.
Right, no, and I'm sorry
and
to
actually,
go back,
and,
but...
And preservation of this argument, because I'm particularly concerned with Mr. Domyanko, did he actually preserve his argument under 2B1.1 as to the foreseeability of the loss?
To address that directly, I believe that the argument was made before the trial court that continuously about the fact that Mr. Domyanko did not know that this buyer was actually a fake person.
But why does that, I mean, I think he kept denying what he had done and sort of at some point just sort of tags on, and thus it wasn't foreseeable to me that there'd be any loss. Maybe that somehow gets into the fake buyer, too. But I don't see a focus on the actual amount of the loan and how much gets recovered and whether the 600 and change figure is reasonably foreseeable to one or both of Domyankos.
Well, and I don't think that defendants are contesting the number. The $603,000 is not what's at issue. It's any loss at all. So during
the... It's all or nothing, you're saying.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, it's that when they went to this closing, they believed they were selling this property to an individual named Robert Valle and that was a legitimate sale. And so they had no reason to know or believe that that would end in a default in a foreclosure. So anything after that sale occurred, after the closing occurred in terms of a foreclosure, was not reasonably foreseeable to them. So any loss that occurred at that point cannot be attributed to them and increase a prison sentence to them.
That's very troublesome to me, though, because if you accept the finding of the court that there has, in fact, been wire fraud in the transaction, then there must be some loss that's foreseeable. The inflated value of the property, if even if the bank had gotten, you know, $750,000 for this house, there still would have been a loss for the bank, maybe at a level below the level that was selected, but...
But I think the loss only came into play because there was this universe of actors that were, for the great part, unrelated to the Domyenkos. And I do think that it's noteworthy to make the distinction between the fraud in the first sale that they're convicted of. And that was something that had no co-defendants. It wasn't something that they conspired with others to do. The second sale and the scheme come about because the property is sold to a fake person, and that ultimately ends up in a default.
Your time is up, so we will take it from there. Mr. Owens. And if you would, Mr. Owens, I would like you to start with this reasonably foreseeable point, because the record is practically non-existent as to why this amount, the $603,000 amount, is reasonably foreseeable to either or both of the Domyenkos. And without that, we have in the past said we need the district judge to explain to us why it found these numbers. I can't find any explanation.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, Derek Owens on behalf of the United States. The reasonably foreseeable aspect of the loss in this case comes in multiple ways. First, kind of an umbrella approach, which I believe the court touched on earlier, which is that the defendants in this case were engaging in a completely fraudulent transaction, regardless of if they knew the buyer was not a real person or not.
And do you think that's a red herring that just doesn't make any difference? Mr. Valet could have been a living, breathing human being. And
right. The evidence was very, very strong that the Domyenkos knew he was a straw buyer. They had agreed to make payments to him directly or through the representatives who he had showing up at the sale for them. And it is a red herring, we believe.
And the fake Mr. Valet himself, Mr. Priest, right?
Mr. Priest, that's correct. Mr. Priest was actually paid. The evidence, Mr. Sigbawu testified that Mr. Priest actually was paid, as well as other individuals on that side of the transaction.
But that doesn't get me to, you know, okay, so there's... So first you have Lilia. Let's take her for a minute. And she, I think, does a much better job preserving this point on the record. She signs the HUD-1 statement. We all understand the HUD-1 statement doesn't reveal some of the people to whom these proceeds are going to be dispersed. That's material, bad. Let's assume the conviction. But how do we get from that point to saying that a loss of $603,000 is reasonably foreseeable to her? She'd have a lower guideline range if it's not that.
Mm-hmm. The sale in this case was over $1 million.
Yeah.
The loan amount was. The bank was putting at risk over $1 million. And her participation in a fraudulent transaction should have been reasonably foreseeable. It was reasonably foreseeable.
But that doesn't tell you the number. You know, so it's $1.1 million, give or take. And if she thought that the house would sell for $800,000, that leads to a different guideline range. I don't know what material we have in the record that tells us where she reasonably foresaw the loss would be. The bank doesn't recover zero when it sells the house. It recovers $487,000.
There's nothing in the record that shows what she thought the house might sell for if it went under.
Isn't that a problem?
I don't think so. This court in Shenneman held that the court should look at the knowledge of the scheme, the coordination of the activities by the members of the scheme, and the length and the degree of the participation in the scheme.
I can imagine an argument to the effect that, look, Lilia Domyenko was fully implicated in the original fraudulent sale at the wildly inflated price, and therefore must have known the fair market value of this house was well below what the second sale was for, and you've got the evidence that she lied about in the HUD-1 statement. So I can imagine getting to that conclusion, but I don't see it in the district judge's explanation.
And that's where I was going.
Okay.
With the, what Shenneman says, what the court should look at. And it's a broad scheme from the first sale all the way through
right,
the second
but what
sale.
You're wanting us to do is take what happened during the trial, because that's what you say essentially in your brief. If you look at what happened during the trial, we can certainly infer how what the judges could, isn't it? I mean, that's your bottom line. We can infer the foreseeability element based on what happened during the trial. And the problem is when it's time for sentencing, the court is supposed to lay it out, even though it might be a duplicate sort of exercise. The court is supposed to lay it out, tie it up, so when we review it, we can see it. Because otherwise, if we buy what you're selling, if we adopt your theory that the intent to defraud necessarily makes the loss reasonably foreseeable, every convicted defendant in a fraud case could be held responsible for every resulting loss, foreseeable or not, because they had the intent to defraud and because that was proven at trial.
In this case, I think it's a little different than every other case that the court just mentioned, because in this case we have it was a court trial where the court made actual findings following presentation of evidence.
And that's what I'm saying. I recognize that you're saying, why can't you? Well, and even if the court has said, and in reaching this conclusion on the $600,000, I rely on the findings I made during the course of this trial. That would have been enough. He could have said findings two, I don't know, you know, he could have cited exactly which finding he was tying, or he could have said it generally. Better to tie it to a paragraph. But if not, if he had said that, we'd at least have something to work with.
And don't you think reasonable foreseeability for sentencing needs to be proven defendant by defendant? Sounds to me like you're saying if it was reasonably foreseeable to Victor, then it was automatically reasonably foreseeable to Lilia. And I'm concerned about that proposition.
Right. That's not our position. And I believe the district court found at sentencing, not at trial, the district court found that both defendants knowingly and intentionally defrauded the lender. Both defendants used sophisticated and premeditated
actions.
Right,
and so those are each defendant. But when you get to the point of saying how much loss was reasonably foreseeable, would you agree that you have to ask how much was reasonably foreseeable to Victor and how much was reasonably foreseeable to Lilia, and the answer might not be the same?
I agree with that.
Okay, so the district court does comment at one point that he thinks Victor, of course his sentence reflects it as well, Victor is the more culpable of the parties, and Lilia kind of goes along and is somehow under his domination. He doesn't go all the way with that. He adjusts her sentence down for it. So I don't see where he spells it out to say what was reasonably foreseeable, especially to her.
I don't think it's spelled out in detail, but I believe under Nature, the court is allowed to look at the entirety of the record that was below in making a determination as to the loss amount.
And then how do you square this with Laskunas, which is made it very clear what had to be spelled out by the court? How do you run away from that?
Well, Nature and White followed Laskunas, and in Laskunas, there was nothing on the record, absolutely nothing. But in Nature as well as in White, I think the court made it clear that the court doesn't have to make written findings. It doesn't have to make their findings essentially all at one time during the sentencing hearing. That the record as a whole can be considered.
But we need to have that record. It's very hard to review sentences if the district judge doesn't tell us on a key point like this. This is not some peripheral issue. It's not a stock argument under 3553A. It's a central point. And I think you're arguing that we have to sit there and, as we like to say, comb through the record to find some little hint here and there from the district court. And that's not practical.
Well, let me ask, you know the record far better than any of us. What's your best indication from the findings at the end of the trial that supports this conclusion?
At the end of the trial, the court made an explicit finding that the defendants intended in this case to obtain gain through the misrepresentations that they made.
Okay.
And then at sentencing, at sentencing he adopted the figure in the PSR. The defendants did not object to that figure. They objected to any loss amount being attributed to them.
Gain and loss are different too, right? They didn't gain as much as Countrymark lost.
That's correct.
Countrywide, sorry.
And in the court's finding, did he name a number?
He adopted the figure in the PSR.
No, I know, but I mean in the findings at the end of the trial. Was a number adopted?
Not at the end of the trial, because that loss amount wasn't calculated until the PSR at sentencing.
So he didn't make any comment on the number and, you know, how much the bank lost, and he didn't do any of that in the
At trial, no, because the PSR really
just generally talked about.
And the court found that their sophisticated and premeditated actions were at the expense of the Bank of America, mm-hmm. and adopted that number from the PSR, all at sentencing.
Anything further?
And unless the court has further questions, the government would ask that the court affirm the conviction as well as the sentence imposed by the district court.
Actually, there's one thing I'd like to go back to, and this actually is on the sufficiency claim, and that is, could you summarize the evidence that Mrs. Domenico, Lilia, knew that of the side payment that would be made to the buyer's agent?
So Ms. Domenico, obviously the first sale regarding the property, that's all documented in our briefs. The second sale, she was present at the closing. There were also individuals from the buyer's side, including the buyer, Mr. Oluwaja, mm-hmm. Mr. Sigbawu, mm-hmm. and Victor, as well as Lilia Domenico, were present. And it was brought up then, Mr. Oluwaja, I'm sorry about that, he brought up that he was not listed in the HUD. He was expecting to be listed in the HUD. And at that point, at that meeting, they came to the agreement that they were going to make this side agreement where it was going to confirm that the buyer would be paid through Mr. Oluwaja.
So the testimony was that this was an agreement reached at that time in front of her. Does she speak English?
She does speak English. There was testimony from the FBI agent who interviewed her, as well as a representative from one of the banks who spoke with her.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll give you another minute. I think you'd run out of time, but you can wrap up.
I'll be very brief. Just with regard to the question about whether Mrs. Domenico speaks English, I would just direct the court to the fact that she spoke a limited amount of English, and there was a defense witness put on at trial, which was her daughter, who testified about the limited amount of English that she spoke. So her understanding of the language is somewhat in question. And then I would just lastly like to point the court's attention to pages 10 and 11 of our opening brief, where we quote the government at trial, where they acknowledge that they, and I quote, "We believe now that there is no evidence that Domenico knew about the stolen identity of Robert Valle." And so for the government to say that Domenico knew that he was a straw buyer is just contradictory to what was said at trial.
Well, a straw buyer is different from a phony, you know, from a fictitious individual. So I guess we need to follow that. But certainly I think there's a concession that they don't know that he's completely fictitious.
And then lastly, very briefly, the Liscunas case that the court brought up, and which I believe Judge Williams authored that opinion, we believe it does support our position that this case should be remanded, at least for a finding on the foreseeability. And I think that the fact that there wasn't a distinct finding made for each defendant as to the amount of loss just proves our point that that was actually never considered by the court below.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. And the court will be in recess until tomorrow.